Guys, hey, welcome back to Celluloid Jelly. I'm CJ Talbot, and with me, as always, is my co-host.
Did you forget my name?
I didn't.
Cesar Alejandro Jr., you made me say it.
Yes.
How are you doing, everyone?
How are you doing, Cesar?
Doing all right. Had a day off today.
Yeah?
It was awesome. Pretty restful. I didn't really do much movie-related stuff, but did a lot of reading.
Oh, so. Yeah? Anything good?
Catching up on comics, mostly. So, some good books, but most of them are just like in the middle of a storyline. So, I'll let you know how it pans out in the next month or two once they finish.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Have you been watching anything? I know you've been. You'd like to watch a horror movie a day during October.
Well, I try to. I'm a bit behind right now.
Obviously, we're here to talk about The Shining, so that's that qualifies as a horror movie.
Yeah, it worked out.
Anything you wanna talk about, or are you saving it all for our next episode?
Well, who knows? I think we actually pushed the recording for this back a couple weeks, so I don't know if it'll be timely to do another horror episode if it's not going to be out before Halloween.
Well, we can just make this one extra long.
It's up to you. Why don't you tell us what you've watched? I'm actually pulling up my list.
Well, I'm definitely well behind you in terms of horror movie watching. I'm a very casual horror fan. I don't dig into the genre as much as I do certain classics like film noir and stuff like that. But I did watch, obviously I watched The Shining to prepare for this. I rewatched both Hellraiser and Hellraiser 2, Hellbound.
Mm-hmm.
Or I should say more appropriately, Hellbound, Hellraiser 2. I rewatched Friday the 13th, the final chapter, which is part 4, for those of you who, I'm sure everybody knows that anyway. But, what else did I watch? I don't know. I know that there's at least a couple others. most of them probably weren't that memorable though.
Okay.
Hellraiser, like, I hadn't seen that for a long time.
I like the first one a lot.
Yeah, it was really great. I love the pieces of the shot where the pieces of the face are kind of like sitting separate from one another. Mm-hmm. and that ending shot with his face kind of pulled out with all the whips and the chains and the hooks in him and everything. There's some grotesqueness. What's the guy's name? Frank? Uncle Frank.
I guess.
Like, the makeup effects on Frank are terrific. As far as, like, being skinless and, like, having that sort of, like, bloody musculature just exposed and glistening the whole movie.
Yeah, I watched that last year as part of my Halloween, like, watch-a-thon.
Yeah.
But the thing that sticks out most for me, definitely, is anything with him, Uncle Frank.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And well,
you know, when he reforms and that end scene specifically too. Yeah.
Well, that's that's I guess it was 1986,
87,
one of those 2 years. But we're getting to the end of the practical effects era, like the late 80s, early 90s. Things started to go CGI.
Yeah, well, I think you can also kind of count that as not just like a trend in visual effects, but I guess a turn away from what horror films would end up being.
Yeah,
I think definitely the 80s had a kind of ultra-violence, gory kind of feel to those that you didn't really have. You had some instances of it, but that wasn't like the overall trend, I think, in horror films in the past.
Yeah. Hellraiser in particular, like, there's also like a really beautiful, obviously it's a nightmare sequence, but a really beautiful dream sequence in the middle of the film too.
You're gonna have to refresh my memory.
Well, just it's not long, but it's the I can't remember the actress's name who plays the main girl in Hellraiser, so forgive me. Yeah, she just, like, she's, like, walking through, I think, her bedroom, and it's like, dark, but...
Is it when she sees the Cenobites?
I don't think so, but it's like it's snowing, almost, but it's not snow, it's, like dust or ash or something like that. Like, it's just really, like, really beautiful imagery. It was just a striking shot.
Maybe it's time for me to revisit that, too.
Yeah.
I've seen the second Hellraiser film once, but it was years ago.
The second one gets more into fantasy territory. Like, it almost feels a little bit like Labyrinth because, you know, it's a constant maze. It's, you know, relatable to the movie we're going to talk about today as well. but, you know, there's a labyrinthian quality to it.
I like that word.
Yeah.
Many syllables.
And I think it's got great music, too, which I was surprised by. Like, yeah, it really...
I don't recall.
Yeah, really great soundtrack on that. Like,
yeah, there's a number of Hellraiser films. I think I've only ever seen one and two, though.
I have seen, I think, one through four, and that was enough. Because they get, you know, the third one is just okay. Borderline not so great. And the fourth one I remember not liking at all.
Okay.
But it's been a really long time. But I've never seen any of the other ones. I hear the most recent one where they replaced Doug Bradley with another actor is terrible. So if you guys out there have any opinions on the Hellraiser series, if you want to recommend any of the later ones, I'm more than willing to watch them.
Or maybe movies,
if you recommend them and say that they're good.
Yeah.
But Friday the 13th Part 4, I was actually going to include that as one of my movies that we talked about on our next horror episode if we did one.
Is that the one where it starts with, like, the father and daughter outside of the cabin by the lake?
No. Part four actually begins with, like, a montage that goes through the first three films.
Yeah, okay. So, like...
And it starts right at the end of the third film. They basically take Jason's body with the axe in the head to the morgue. So the first part of... Final chapter plays out in the hospital, like Halloween 2 does.
Okay, so I guess number 5 is the one I'm thinking about. Is number 4 the one where... Wait.
Number 4 is the one where it's about a family who lives on the outskirts of Crystal Lake. It's not. It doesn't take place in the camp. It's they live in a home outside Crystal Lake, and there is a home next to them that is rented to 6 teenagers. Which I found completely hilarious because...
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's like, wait, the girl's father drowned in the lake previously, though.
I don't remember.
She has, like, psychic powers or something, right?
No. That's okay. A different one. All right. No. I found... this is the one with Corey Feldman. Where he shaves his head at the end. And tries to confuse Jason.
You know, I'm not sure, you know, the way you're describing, I don't think, maybe I've never seen that one.
Well, this one in particular it's not one of the best ones in the series. Maybe, maybe it is, you know, because to be honest, and don't send me any hate mail or death threats, I don't think they're that good in general.
Is that the one where, like, the last scene ends inside a graveyard cemetery?
Very last scene? No. The one after this begins in a graveyard, though, with, like, Corey Feldman watching in part 5, two guys try to dig up Jason's body, and, like, I think Corey Feldman watches them from, like, the woods as lightning strikes the rod, and it reanimates Jason from the lightning strike.
Okay. Maybe I'm thinking about number 6 with the psychic girl.
She's in the Jason Goes to Hell, I think, the psychic girl.
No, it's an earlier one.
Really?
Yeah. The thing
it's definitely not in the first 5, though.
Okay. Yeah. It must be number 6, because, like, it's the same thing. I guess as a child, her father...
The fifth one, it's not actually Jason Voorhees. It's a copycat killer, and Tommy Jarvis is on, like, a farm that's for people who are suffering from, like...
Oh, okay. Yeah, the one I'm thinking about is definitely number 6, then.
Yeah, okay. The thing I
find... The final chapter.
well... I started to say this earlier, but, like, this one holds a special significance for me because it was the first one that I'd ever seen, part 4. And I was very young, and I went to a birthday party, and they, you know, we all snuck downstairs and basically watched this movie. instead of doing what we were supposed to do for the birthday. Mm-hmm. So at the time, it felt like really like bloody and grotesque, and it was kind of, you know, like we were getting away with something, you know, which we were because it's an R-rated movie. But rewatching it recently, it's really not that bloody. In fact, they don't even show you Jason that much. Like they show you like from the knees down, like his shoes and the bottom of his legs a lot, and then flashes of him a little bit here and there, but they don't go like full Jason until the end of the movie, which I thought was actually like a nice creative choice. So as the movie goes on, every kill gets maybe just a little bit bloodier. So like the last couple are pretty bloody.
What was the most like graphic kill?
The one that sticks out in my head is he kills, there are two girls who are twins, and one of them is upstairs in the house having sex with somebody, and the other one tries to get her to leave, and she won't. So she walks outside, and it's raining. She has a raincoat on, and she goes to get a bike to ride home. And he kills her, and you see him throw her up against the side of the house, like, with a spear through her, so that she sticks to the wall. It's awesome. So, but that's, yeah, like, the ending of the movie... and I'm sorry that I'm half spoiling this for you since you haven't seen it in a while or haven't seen it at all.
These films are all pretty much the same.
Yeah, essentially, like, Corey Feldman is, like, the younger brother. And instead of having a final girl, his older sister and him both survive. But, yeah, like, in order to beat Jason, he's going to kill the older sister. And Corey Feldman shaves his head and uses a picture of Jason as a young child. And kind of does like tries to make it like his face look like Jason, and runs downstairs and calls his name and tries to confuse him, and that allows them to kind of get the upper hand. So
okay,
so you know,
number four,
yeah,
I think the very first Friday 13th film I ever saw was Takes Manhattan.
Oh yeah, that's eight, right?
Seven,
eight,
seven or eight? I don't
know. Got to be eight.
It's someone with Kelly Hu in it.
Yeah, it's eight.
Yeah, I guess.
Yep.
That was the very first one, which I guess was like, what, 1990? 91?
Yeah.
I guess. So, I mean, I don't really remember much about it, except for, like, the guy wearing the Eddie Murphy / Michael Jackson red suit, the boxer.
Yeah.
And I remember Kelly Hu dying really ridiculously inside, like, the disco inside the ship.
Yeah.
I remember that was like an awful kill.
The fourth one, it's Crispin Glover's one of the kids.
Oh, is that the one where he sings or dances or something?
Yeah.
Okay, is that one?
Oh, the stuff with the teenagers is hilarious because there's all like there's some really funny stuff with all of them, like the sexual politics of the group and all of them being like really fickle and like just swapping partners. Like, and one of the main girls is, and I can't remember her name, is the dark haired girl from Weird Science. The one who plays,
why it's,
Deb? Wait, is Deb the blonde and Hilly's the, it's either Deb or Hilly, the dark haired one.
Okay.
Yeah. So she's
the one with Wyatt, I guess she ends up with him at the end.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The blonde one ends up with Gary. Yes. So, I just want to apologize.
The one from American Ninja.
Is she an American Ninja? The first one?
Isn't she the girl?
Michael Dudikoff?
Isn't she the girl?
I don't know. I haven't seen that movie for years. I wouldn't know.
Oh, man. I don't watch American Ninja. Next week. Next week, guys.
American Ninja, episode 9.
I think it's her. I mean, I don't know.
You might be right. I can't remember. But there's there's a fair amount of TNA in the fourth one. Cool. For you know, people who are looking for that.
Cool.
And there's a couple good kills. Like I said, it's not really bloody till the end, though.
Yeah.
The film
I was confusing this one with, number six, would have been. The kill I remember from that one is the one where he interrupts a couple that are hooking up inside a tent, and he pulls a girl.
That happens in every movie, I think.
Yeah, he pulls a girl out of a tent in the sleeping bag, and he swings the sleeping bag into a tree.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I remember...
I don't remember that.
I think that's one of the... I think it's one of the more iconic kills that he's done over the years.
Okay.
Because there's a new Friday the 13th video game, and that's one of the kills that they feature.
They recreate, yeah.
In, like, whatever, the killing montage to introduce the game.
I have seen all of them except for Jason X and Freddy versus Jason and the remake. I haven't seen any of those. So I've only seen the first eight.
I've never seen 10. I guess the one you're talking about, number four, and the remake, those ones I haven't seen.
It's funny. Oh, well, you know, I mean, and I think we've talked about this before, but, like, I haven't seen the first one for a while, but the first one definitely owes a debt of gratitude to Bay of Blood. Yeah, to one of my favorite Mario Bava movies, Bay of Blood, so which is definitely a Friday the 13th-like film, the first movie, like, no psycho killer Jason Voorhees.
So
that's a recommendation right there, guys, so listen up. Check out Bay of Blood by Mario Bava.
I'm pretty sure that's on
Netflix. Of the best.
Is it on Netflix right now?
Not anymore. No, they took all his films off. Kino Lorber, who does those?
I'm uncertain.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they lost their deal with Kino, and that a lot of that stuff disappeared. A lot of the silent movies that Kino had on disappeared from Netflix, so
okay.
Yeah.
I guess in the past month, like you said, I've been watching a lot of horror films.
Yeah, I know. Well, you were going to talk about Tale of Two Sisters. You want to do that real quick?
I didn't rewatch it, though.
Oh, really?
It's not fresh in my mind yet.
Okay.
So, I mean, I've seen it. I try to watch it once a year, but I didn't watch it last year. So it's been more than a year, more than 2 years, I guess, since I've seen it.
Well, if you wanted to let our listeners know one movie that you've rewatched or seen for the first time this month that's horror related that they should check out before Halloween, what would it be?
I saw this very interesting Danish film called When Animals Dream.
Okay.
It stars, I'm definitely going to butcher these names, but it stars a young actress.
Welcome to my world.
Named Sonia Sohn or Sonia Sewell. And Lars Mikkelsen, who is the older brother of Mads Mikkelsen.
Oh, wow.
Most people, looking at him, you could certainly tell that they're related. But I think most people would know him from House of Cards or...
Which season?
Season 3.
Oh, yeah, I haven't gone past 2.
He plays, like, the Russian president in the show. And in Sherlock, he plays... Which I do not watch. Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman. He plays Magnuson? Thomas Magnuson, I guess. He's a guy that has the same, uses the same memory system that Sherlock uses to recall stuff eidetically.
Okay.
This movie, When Animals Dream, is kind of like a coming-of-age film about this young girl who... you know, her mother's ill, and townspeople seem kind of weird around her and her family. She doesn't really know why her mother is ill, or why, like, the townspeople are standoffish. But as she, as a coming age film, she starts experiencing typical things that teenagers experience. At the same time, finding scratches and rashes developing on her body.
Okay.
And it's
ew.
It's like a werewolf film, and basically she finds out that. She's got something in her, that isn't entirely natural.
Okay.
The movie is actually pretty short, maybe around 80 minutes or so. And it's very, very slow paced. To be honest, I would probably compare it to Let the Right One In.
Oh, yeah?
I thought this film was quite good. I think there's some very terrific, like, long take scenes and a lot of establishing shots that kind of, like, showcase, like, this harbor town that the film takes place in. You know, small houses, a lot of I guess mountainous and hilly areas.
Okay.
I really like the photography in the film particularly.
Is this a film where you eventually get sort of like transformation scenes, or do they kind of stay away from that and make it more psychological?
You do get to see quite a bit more of the werewolf in her towards the end of the film.
Okay.
But I guess a lot of the first half of the film is about this discovery, I guess, for her. You get a general idea right off the bat as an audience member going into the film. So you're kind of just waiting for her to kind of put it together and, hopefully makes sense of why everyone, including her father, her mother, and doctors, are all acting kind of odd.
Okay. Did you see this theatrically on Netflix, Hulu?
Oh, it was on Netflix.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
and what's it called again?
When Animals Dream.
When Animals Dream. Okay. I will have to add that to my queue.
Besides that, I mean, I guess yesterday I watched Trick or Treat, which is a perennial favorite.
Love it.
Was Michael, who's a director.
Did you rewatch that because yesterday at work we were talking about it with people?
No.
Okay. I did, though.
Maybe. Okay. Well, maybe I didn't watch it yesterday. Maybe I watched it 2 days ago.
Okay.
But, you know.
Great Halloween movie. Definitely. If you guys haven't seen Trick or Treat, Trick or Treat, definitely check that out. That's, who's in it? Dylan Baker, Anna Paquin.
Leslie Bibb.
Yeah.
Temo Pennycat.
Yeah.
Brian Cox.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Brian Cox.
Love Brian Cox.
Who else is in that? There should be plenty.
It's a pretty loaded cast. It's an anthology movie, so it's a bunch of different stories that take place on the same town on Halloween. Directed by Mike Dougherty, right?
Yeah.
Who was previously notable for writing at least one of the X-Men movies for Bryan Singer and X-Men Superman 2? Returns.
X-Men 2.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that movie sat on the shelf for a long time, right?
Yeah, I recall. I guess the film didn't actually get a release until probably around 2008, 2009.
Well, I remember, you know, because we were both working at Suncoast at the time, that it was supposed to get a theatrical release, and they shit-canned that idea. And the trailer was in front of 300.
Yes.
And
300 was released in 2006.
Yeah.
So.
And so it took over 2 years before they finally released it on DVD, and they just dumped it in September, if I'm not mistaken. And we had talked it up so much that we had as many reservations for that as we would have had for, like, a really major mainstream big hit movie. Mm-hmm. To be honest, it didn't disappoint. I really like that movie a lot.
It's a movie that I think is getting more fans every year. And it's a movie that something I always think that people should do is, you know, if you enjoy a film, you should talk about it and try to get other people to see it.
Absolutely.
That's a film that I find that when people view it, they do it on their own. Even people who don't typically recommend, it's a movie I've always heard people, suggesting to other people.
Yeah. I have not rewatched that in a while, but that's definitely one that I will rewatch between now and Halloween.
Yeah.
So. I did rewatch The Exorcist too. I rewatched The Exorcist also, the first one, and I watched the theatrical version, not the unrated director's cut one. So no spider walking scene.
Is that version available? Because I own the version you've never seen. Is that on that?
That is the director's cut.
But is it on that other one? I don't have it on Blu-ray. So.
No, it's not on the DVD, but the new Blu-ray, which I picked up at Suncoast at a fair price, go check it out, has both the theatrical and the director's cut, and it's got a hardcover excerpt from Friedkin's book, Friedkin Connection, which we talked about a little bit when we did the Sorcerer podcast.
Did you mess around with the special features or anything with it?
No, not at all. I meant to, at some point, watch the director's cut also, but I haven't gotten around to it, and I don't know if I will. I just, you know.
You just watched it recently, so.
About 2 weeks ago, yeah. Probably. But I think I'm going for more variety this month, you know, as opposed to rewatches, so I'm going to try to dig into a few other things.
Yeah. I had a couple other rewatches. House of the Devil was one I watched a couple weeks ago. I
love that movie. Please talk about that movie.
Ty West. It's
sorry, we'll get to The Shining eventually.
Yeah, it's a throwback film that's meant to, it certainly looks and sounds like it could have been shot in the 70s or 80s.
That's one of my favorite things about it, is that it literally looks and feels like it came from that era.
Yeah, it's like it's a lost film. That's pretty much how it's kind of presented.
Yeah.
The film is about a young girl who, she's a college student, and she finds a place to live, but she needs to make money for the deposit before she can get that place. So she takes a babysitting job, which turns out to be not exactly what she expected. And she's been told to watch, a gentleman's elderly mother as opposed to his child. When she gets to the house, a number of odd things start happening, and she finds out that she was drawn there specifically for a purpose.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah,
it's good. I mean, it's real good.
The movie is a slow burn. I think it's probably one of the more impressive surprises.
Horror fans will recognize that Tom Noonan is the owner of the house.
Elderly man with the cane.
Greta Gerwig is also in it as like the best friend of the main character.
Yeah.
Dee Wallace Stone is also
the best friend, aka Voice of Reason.
Yeah. AJ Bowen is also in it, who has been in a lot of his films.
Yeah, Ty West and Adam Wingard.
Yeah. And Jocelyn Donahue plays the lead. Hmm. And she's great, definitely. Yeah, it's really good. 100%.
Yep.
Go check that one out.
Besides that, yeah, I don't know. It's maybe loosely a horror movie, but I saw the new Godzilla film earlier last week,
I guess. Saw you post your review of that. Shin Godzilla?
Yes. I guess internationally it was also known as Godzilla Resurgence, but Shin Godzilla, I guess, literally translates to New Godzilla or The Real Godzilla. So certainly that's kind of like a jab at Legendary Pictures' recent big hit Godzilla adaptation. Right.
Which they had to sign off on that though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they had to sign off for the rights, not necessarily sign off on,
they took some money though, didn't they?
Final cut.
All right, then. Screw off, Toho.
To who? Yeah, I mean, it's very good. Maybe CJ will, maybe we'll have a link to my review, but it's...
Didn't you already post it in the Celluloid Jelly?
I guess in there, yeah. I guess maybe not. I think I did.
But yeah, if you I'm remember, pretty sure you did. Yeah.
It's playing a limited release in the United States currently, so you know, I suggest getting your butts out there. It may not be playing
very long when
you hear this. But overall, I think most people are enjoying it. It's pretty heavily political, and it certainly feels like a Godzilla film that's a product of the times. When you take into consideration the current political climate of Japan, as well as some of the major historical and social events that have happened in Japan within the last 5 or so years.
Okay. Such as?
I think definitely the biggest thing that they reference would be the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami.
Okay.
Which, you know, of course, resulted in the Fukushima nuclear power plant melting down. Now, Godzilla, he's always been a character that's always been a... I guess, the embodiment of nuclear fear in Japan.
Right.
Being the only nation to ever have nuclear weapons used on their soil, you know, it's almost like historical fear that many people who are Japanese have. And, you know, this is just like a modern reflection of it. I don't have any doubt in my mind that this film will, you know, probably in a few years... maybe not in a few years, but quite a ways down the line, will stand the test of time, and it'll be pretty indicative of this period of time, especially in Japanese cinema with how iconic the character is, and I think how present the movie kind of takes the subject matter.
I just like listening to you, you know, talk about Japanese
cinema. Talk about Godzilla.
Yeah, man. Definitely.
Yeah.
No, that's great, man. I, you know, I'm not that big a Godzilla fan, but, you know, it sounds like it's really good.
I think the scenes with Godzilla, there's not as much, but I'd say it's quite a bit more than, say, the 1954 version.
Okay.
Tonally, it's very serious, but the scenes with Godzilla are terrific. It's almost like...
is it a man in a suit?
It's not. It's the gentleman, I believe, who wore the suit for the last suited Godzilla film, which was Final Wars. I can't recall his name right now, but I believe he did motion capture for Godzilla. For this film, as opposed to using a suit. So it's CG. Overall, it's mostly impressive. Godzilla looks terrific. The only time CG looks a little odd is when they have big, scenes of awkward destruction. Like Godzilla's first appearance, he does not appear the way Godzilla looks as most people would know, or even on the poster. But there's a scene where he shows up and he's... going through a canal way, and he's pushing boats out of the way, and the boats kind of look a little flimsy.
Okay.
Now, the film was also supposed to be a premium format film originally, so sometimes I've noticed that a lot of 3D films, they kind of get away with shoddier effects work, with the intention of it looking better in like 3D.
Right. Okay. But you recommend it definitely.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Godzilla, he destroys a hell of a lot of buildings, and there's, you know, I said it's kind of, you know, tangentially related as a horror film, but the Godzilla as a character in this film, you know, he's a character or a figure that doesn't have lines, doesn't speak, but there's a certain body language that's articulated, which I guess is also true in the bodysuit versions. But, like, in the film, Godzilla, he changes. So he kind of, like, evolves and turns into the one we see when you imagine your mind Godzilla initially.
Right.
And there's a certain kind of, like, body horror element to it.
Okay.
Which, in my mind, reminded me quite a bit of, like, American Werewolf in London.
All right, cool.
Like, it's, like, Godzilla's existence is painful.
Yeah. That movie still holds up pretty well. I rewatched that last year, American Werewolf.
It's been a while since I've seen that film. Yeah,
it's really good. Well, there one of the, I don't know if you'd call it a lost Godzilla movie, but one of the ones that had never been available here in the U.S. is now available on DVD and Blu-ray. The, what is it called, Return of the Godzilla?
Yes, the 1984 version.
Right, which was it recut and released here as Godzilla 85?
Yes, they added Raymond Burr back into it.
Right, okay. So that is available now on home video. Is that one any good?
It is. It's a lot darker. It's really, really dark. Yeah. So honestly, like I haven't watched the Return of Godzilla in a long time. It's but I recall it being very mature, and it really does feel like this newer film feels a lot like that one.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Well, go pick that up. go pick that up if you're a monster movie fan or a Godzilla fan.
It's an exciting time.
Yeah, cool. You want to get to The Shining?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
What's The Shining about, CJ?
Oh, geez. The Shining, which is I would say at this point loosely based on Stephen King's novel of the same name, is about a family, a mother, father, and child, who go to live by themselves in a gigantic resort as caretakers over a harsh winter, and very quickly descend into madness.
Very quickly.
Yes. Yeah. Quicker than I remember, actually.
There's a progression to it, but yeah, it happens pretty...
Yeah, obviously we'll get to the finer points of the, you know, you know, the little boy has psychic abilities and, you know, and
okay, I guess that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So long, guys. No.
But, you know, Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, the little boy whose name in the movie is Danny is played by Danny Lloyd. Scatman Carruthers plays
Scatman.
Yeah, he's so great. That fucking...
You want some ice cream?
That's not what I'm talking about. But when they cut to him in Miami...
He's got, like, the art on his
head. Oh, dude, his room is amazing. It's so great.
He's so chill.
He's great, though. He is the, I don't know if you call him the head cook or the chef, or whatever they call the head of the kitchen of the hotel. And he also has a psychic ability, which he refers to as Shining, where he can see both the past and the future, and things that other people maybe choose to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
about things. So he has, you know, one very nice scene with Danny where they talk a little bit about Shining and about the hotel in particular, which is really good. And that's where, as an audience, we first learn of room 237 and some, terrible things that happened.
A lot of terrible things.
Yeah. You know, it's pretty great. It's Stanley Kubrick. So, you know, you're getting, a level of precision and perfectionism that rarely is established by other filmmakers in their work. So,
yeah, I think The Shining has certainly stood the test of time, and I probably haven't seen The Shining for a few years, more than a few years, at least five, before rewatching this, I guess about a week or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
For the recording that we're doing right now. But I think there's a lot of people who hold it in very high regard, and I think it's, you know, rightly deserved. I don't know that it's necessarily a horror film that a lot of modern audiences can get into, though.
Well, it does not. Most modern horror has become, regardless, and I'm not just hating on shaky camera work, but most modern horror has become a series of false starts, high anticipation, low payoff, quick cuts. You know, it's different. Like, Kubrick is making a film that does not adhere to any of what we consider to be the modern hallmarks of a horror movie. Kubrick famously was originally going to do The Exorcist. So I don't know, you know, I don't know if you knew that. So
I didn't. Did you hear about that when you're after you rewatched The Exorcist?
No, I in college I picked up a couple of books on Kubrick, autobiography and a collection of like interviews and stuff. And for a while I was on a you know, I was a big Kubrick nerd. And I was on a big kick, and I rewatched his films over and over and over again.
I think you're still kind of a Kubrick nerd.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And that fell through, and he ended up doing A Clockwork Orange and then moved on, and The Exorcist had already been done. I think very well by our boy William Friedkin.
Good old Billy.
Billy Hurricane Friedkin. you know, Kubrick... you know, they apparently Warner Brothers wanted to develop The Shining as a movie, and Stephen King himself took a swipe at the screenplay and delivered a first draft to Warner Brothers. And when Kubrick signed on, they gave him that screenplay, and apparently he threw it in the trash and never read it and started from scratch. So
okay,
I mean, he read the book obviously, but did not read King's screenplay because obviously he knew that there were things that he was going to change immediately and didn't want to be beholden to King at all.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently though, there were a series of phone calls between him and King, and then King famously hated the movie. So,
well, I mean, I guess, in the early 90s, mid 90s or so, no, 97, I guess, ABC produced a miniseries adaptation of The Shining,
with sci-fi, right?
ABC? I want to say ABC.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure it was network television.
The one with
Stephen Weber.
Stephen Weber. That was, yeah, sci-fi. The production quality is terrible on it.
Yeah, I think it's ABC.
It's pretty bad CGI on like the hedge animals and stuff.
I don't really remember. Yeah. I saw it way back when. That's why in my mind I thought it was ABC. Maybe
you might
not.
Be right, but I mean, ABC did a lot of Stephen King. Like they were the ones who did the It.
Like, and Langoliers and stuff.
Yeah, so. But I'm pretty sure The Shining, which was done in the 90s, right?
97?
Yeah, like late 90s, was sci-fi.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'm gonna pretend that I'm the authority on this. It was definitely sci-fi.
I'm just going to accept it, and I'm sure at the end of this episode, you guys can find out who was right or wrong.
Well, there'll be egg on my face, I guess, if I'm wrong, so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can all have fun.
So, yeah, I mean, in the miniseries, Stephen, you know, it was adapted. I think Stephen King actually wrote the teleplay for it.
Yeah, it's much more faithful.
Yeah. According to him. So, I mean, I've heard a couple of reports of him, you know, you said famously hating Kubrick's The Shining, but right. Also saying, you know, the opposite of that at other points in time.
I probably, as he's gotten older, he's mellowed a little bit on it, but I think he was really kind of butthurt originally, so.
Butthurt's the right word, yeah. I guess.
you know, and regardless, a Stanley Kubrick film is a singular experience. He's very famous for taking source material and bending it and twisting it and doing something different with it. We talked about Dr. Strangelove. Dr. Strangelove was based on a serious book called Red Alert. And they tried to do a serious screenplay for it, and things were so absurd that they started to laugh, and they realized that it would work better as a comedy. So I'm sure whoever wrote the novel of Red Alert probably hated Dr. Strangelove. I don't know for sure, but it would totally make
sense.
Stick
to books.
Yeah. But anyway, so. I will go on record and say that as much as I love Kubrick films, and I definitely appreciate The Shining quite a bit, I'm not 100% sure I like this movie.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
This is going to be interesting.
Well, it's not. I mean, I don't have any really strong feelings one way or the other. Like, there's some really, like, knockout great things in this film. But in general, I just don't feel like I engage with it a whole lot.
It's a lonely movie.
I guess. You know, I think one of the things is probably...
I think Shelley Duvall is a huge weakness of this picture.
I'm not 100% sure that... I don't feel the same way. I'm not going to say you're wrong. Obviously, I would disagree a little bit, because I think you can look at The Shining, and I've not read King's book, so I don't...
Neither have I, so this is just, uninformed opinion,
but
guys.
But looking at Kubrick's work, and you mentioned Room 237 earlier, which is a documentary that features some of the wildest conspiracy theories about The Shining, almost all of which, and I haven't gotten through the entire movie because... I just get bored and, because it's so ridiculous. And I think I got like an hour into it the last time and turned it off. But there are all these theories about how, obviously, people think Kubrick
directed the moon
faked the moon landing, and that The Shining was his way of exorcising his demons and releasing his guilt over the moon landing. Other people, look at all of the... Native American imagery and design in the hotel, and say that it's all about the purging of the Native Americans and guilty pioneer stuff, and there's all kinds of crazy wacky stuff. But when I look at it, the thing that really and bear with me because I haven't really like fleshed this out too well. The thing that strikes me the most, though, is that it's sort of just an allegory for substance abuse, which is an obvious thing because he is an alcoholic and,
trying to be sober.
But the idea that that Shelley Duvall is such a weak character, she's a real doormat, is very fitting for the idea that she has an abusive husband. And so when I look at her performance, I see very specifically that she's meant to be, shrill, frail, and not at all a physical match for him, because when you are an abuser, you look for people who can't be a physical match for yourself. That's my half-hearted defense of Shelley Duvall, I guess.
Okay.
There are scenes in the movie where I think she's quite good, but I think, like Nicholson, she doesn't get to ham it up the way he does. And Kubrick's very famous for doing a lot of takes, and one of the things that that I know just through, research, reading, whatever, is that the editor on this movie... has many different times said that Kubrick was famous for never using the best takes. That if Nicholson's best take was take 30, he would still do 25 more takes and get something that was just more off kilter, more odd, more strange, more surprising. And that's what they would use, even though dramatically a different take would have worked better. And I think, with Nicholson, you can look at that strangeness in the performance and enjoy it. And with Shelley Duvall, it comes off much more awkward. And that's why I think a lot of people don't like her performance as much. But I think that her performance, like his, is just a quarter turn in the wrong direction in many cases. And it's just not as fun as Nicholson's version.
Okay.
Like that.
Well, you can tell me if you feel the same way, but doesn't Jack Nicholson, he just seems sinister just looking at the guy?
Of course.
Just as Jack Nicholson,
yeah.
not as, you know.
Well, this is 1980, but I mean, look at his work in the 70s. He's a hothead or a crazy person in almost every movie. I mean, so that's why you cast Jack Nicholson. You know, I mean, he's a star, you know, so obviously you're putting, you know, butts in seats, you know, just by casting him in your movie. But you cast Jack Nicholson specifically over Al Pacino or somebody like that because he has that very dangerous quality to him. You know, you could put De Niro in that role, maybe, at that time, late 70s. Mm-hmm. If you look at Taxi Driver, you could probably see that De Niro probably would have been a pretty good Jack Torrance. You know, but Nicholson has that too. Sure. Nicholson has a more devilish quality.
I think so.
De Niro is very dangerous and unpredictable, but he doesn't come across as devilish.
Sure.
Or charming.
I would agree with
which
that.
Which Nicholson is charming. So.
Here's to 5 miserable months.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I think maybe prevents me from liking the movie so much, and this is maybe the reason that Kubrick liked it and intended it to be this way, but there's no overlapping dialogue. No overlapping dialogue. And
well, there's only really 4 characters in this whole film.
Yeah, well, but there's always like an awkward pause between lines. Between people, like early in the movie,
it's when they're walking around. Like, well, the hotel.
I think it's most prevalent in the interview scene, and also in the scene where the three of them are in the Volkswagen driving to the Overlook Hotel. Like the interview scene in particular, as someone myself who has interviewed a number of people in my position. Usually when someone is a good interviewer, they're not always a good fit for the position. Mm-hmm. Like when they seem a little too polished, when they give you just the right answer every single time out, like that's always something that I'm a little put off by. And like, I think it's strange. And it actually gives me like that yellow light. I'm given a pause, you know, on that candidate. And his interview scene, there's 10 chances for him to run in the other direction screaming, like mm-hmm. Let me out of here. I'll go back to teaching school. but every time he's got like that sort of charming look on his face and gives them exactly the right answer, you know, like, oh, you know, people can really go crazy, you know, being all isolated for the entire winter. Well. And Nicholson gives you that devilish smile and he says, well, that's exactly what I'm looking for, you know. And then after he tells him the Grady story about the guy chopping up his family, Nicholson's response is, well, you don't have to worry about anything. That's not what's going to happen to me. And I'm sure my wife will love it because she's a confirmed horror and true story nut or something mm-hmm. like that.
Sure, you're like Stephen King.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like I think Kubrick does a good job of setting you up in the first like 3 or 4 scenes of this movie with things being they're very normal things, driving to a hotel, taking an interview, you know, Danny and his mother around the kitchen table, mm-hmm. Where he's eating like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It's the first time we see Tony. And there's something just unsettling and odd about every single one of those scenes. So, you know, like, it's perfectly set up. It's very well done. It just, like, I don't know, like, I can't connect with it that well.
Hmm. See, I like, you know, those scenes are, I'm trying to remember, they don't have, like, music or anything playing. You'd have, like, maybe TV or radio playing a little bit in the background.
There's music in, well, there's music over the credits, obviously, which is haunting. It's terrific. And those helicopter shots are beautiful. Mm-hmm. You're probably right. The ones that we're talking about, the first couple scenes, it's ambient sound and sound from direct sources like radios or TVs.
Yeah, I think whenever I see stuff like that, especially going into the film, knowing it's a horror film, having that fly on the wall, like... almost look at it, you know, and Kubrick, he tends to like linger on shots a little bit.
Oh yeah.
When you see it, the longer you look at stuff, the more uncomfortable you feel, but he forces you kind of to like confront it. Like a good example would be
12 Years a Slave?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's...
Kubrick never went that far with a single take.
Well, sure. I mean, can definitely see that Steve McQueen is, you know, heavily influenced. But there's, you know, that scene when he's hanging. Holy shit.
So rough. Holy oh my God. Shit. Yeah, 12 Years a Slave, man. God.
Yeah, I remember...
brutal.
Yeah, we watched it.
Yeah, we saw it together.
Yeah. And, you know, it's rough seeing it happen, like, right then.
Oh, yeah.
When they pull it. And then the fact that it goes on for, like, what, 5 or 6 minutes?
It's gut-wrenching. Like all of them are, but, like, especially the two scenes, the one where he gets whipped.
Yeah, right
at the beginning. And the one where he's hung earlier in the film, mm-hmm. where the camera just sits on him as people go about their daily business and just sits on him and sits on him for what seems like an eternity, but I'm sure it's probably more like 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, there's that, I mean, and the scene where Lupita Nyong'o is getting whipped by Solomon, so... Yeah. I can't remember what her character's name is, though.
I don't recall either.
Oh, man. Ugh. Depressed.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's get back to The Shining.
Let's get to some brighter territory with The Shining.
Let's get to an axe murder instead of, like, real-life horror.
Yeah, I mean, the movie itself doesn't really have a high kill count, unless you look at, like, the grander picture, like, you know, the legacy of it.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a number of pretty unsettling things that go on in this film.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of weird stuff. You know, I mean, Nicholson obviously has visions. There's the scene in room 237 with the naked woman in the bathtub, mm-hmm. who turns into the old hag with the body decomposing. There's the gold ballroom scene where he walks in and we meet Lloyd the bartender, and then Grady comes into the picture and they have that scene in the bathroom. Great bathroom. Red bathroom with all those mirrors and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's I can't remember if he does it a second time anywhere else, but he breaks the 180 line in that scene where he flips perspective, like, from one side of the actors to the other. It's very jarring, but it's used effectively there.
Is that the line when he says, you've always been the caretaker?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's that bit.
Yeah, I like that. That is, I don't know if it's my favorite scene, but that scene is one that, like, I think is terrific because, like, you know, Grady, obviously, he spills, I don't know, what is it, like, white wine or something
on him? Mimosa or orange juice or something.
Yeah, something on him. And they go into the bathroom and Grady's trying to, like, you know, blot the stuff off of his outfit. And Jack realizes who it is and confronts him about it and he denies it. And then he plays, like, maybe it is, but then he can't remember. And then he just freely admits to it. And then he denies that he's the caretaker, but that Jack has always been the caretaker.
Mm-hmm.
I just think the way that scene plays out, it's fascinating to watch.
I think, man, 2 weeks out from watching this film, it's killing me. I don't remember specific lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I do like that scene, too.
All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
Yeah. Something, something.
Yeah. One of the conspiracy theories is that, well, you know, the vision, the only time Wendy sees something that is odd is at the end of the picture.
When she's running to the lobby?
Yeah, I think it's after she gets Danny out of the house.
Yes, after.
Before she goes in the bathroom. Think.
No. Well, she's in the bathroom, and Jack, she and Danny are both in the bathroom, and then Jack tries to break in.
Well, she puts Danny out the window,
mm-hmm. And Jack's still in there until he hears whatever Scatman Crothers, whatever his character's name is, Mister. Roll up in the snow.
I think this scene, the vision she has comes earlier than that, though, right? Where she sees the man who's in like a bear suit or a
no,
suit.
That's. I think that's when she's looking for Danny at the end. Because she has a number of visions as she's going down. That, like, back from wherever the room down to the lobby. So she sees that. She sees the elevator blood scene. And she sees... she runs into the guy with, like, the busted head. In, like, the suit, 1920s, like, tuxedo.
Okay. I'm going to take your word for it.
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
But I mean, think of how many times she's, you know, like, after a certain point, how many times is she with Danny? not that many times.
Well, not until she gets outside, I guess, right?
Oh, and she has that scene where she sees like skeletons sitting in like the parlor. That's like a quick succession.
Yes. Yeah. I do remember that. Okay. Well, anyway, one of the conspiracy theories is that because she sees the guy who's in, I guess it's supposed to be a bear costume.
That's so creepy, man.
But he's performing,
oral sex,
an act on a gentleman who is in a tuxedo, I guess, right? An older gentleman in a tuxedo.
I can't remember. Is he holding a martini or a glass or something?
I don't think so. I don't know. Earlier in the movie, when the pediatrician comes to see Danny, his pillow is like that bear suit or dog suit or whatever it is. So like the conspiracy
that's
theory,
in that movie. Is that in 237?
It is, but that like I've read that in other places as well. But so the
was
idea
was it before 237 came out, or people just regurgitating?
No, I think it is. Okay. But so people think that's a nod by Kubrick, that whether it's true or not, that Wendy believes that Jack may have been abusing Danny sexually. Food for thought, I guess. Yeah. If that's the kind of thing you want to think about.
Well, a lot of the scenes when Danny and Jack are very uncomfortable.
Yeah, very much so. When he goes,
like, you never hurt me, Daddy, would you?
Right. Well, when he goes up to get that car and Jack calls him over and sits him on his lap and you think something weird is going to happen and it doesn't, but it just is strange and uncomfortable all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
maybe the strength of the film as a horror film isn't necessarily from the shocking moments, but it's certainly from the unease you feel watching the film.
Yeah, and certain images do linger.
Yeah, I do tend to enjoy that type of horror where, the unease and the atmospheric, take on it, where you don't feel something's right ever. I tend to gravitate towards those type of horror films as opposed to like the quick jump scares or excessive gore. That's a lot of times that doesn't do much for me in the long run.
Yeah, that definitely gives this movie a surreal quality.
Especially if you're invested in the characters.
Yeah. I don't know if you know this, but we talked about on a previous podcast after watching 2001 in the theater, the idea that Kubrick had edited that film and taken some of it off after it had been in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happened with The Shining. After its first weekend of release in America, he sent an editor and they removed the final scene from the movie. Where Ullman, who is the guy who hires Jack for the gig at the Overlook Hotel, goes to visit Wendy and Danny in the hospital at the end of the film and tells them that there is no evidence of anything ever happening there and that they can't find the body of Jack. So you think that maybe the entire thing is just her hallucination. So they took that out, though.
Oh, okay. Well, they said Jackson won the job. Right? So what would...
I know. Well...
Yeah, I'm glad they took it out.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm glad they took it out, too.
There's a quick scene of Jack staring through the window in like the hospital.
Well, that Here's Johnny thing is something that, I'm sure...
That was improvised, though, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, okay. Yep. Apparently Jack was a big Johnny Carson fan.
Guess so.
Yeah.
That's the only thing they have on TV. I don't overlook.
We should talk about the cinematography and the beautiful Steadicam shots, which became a hallmark of Kubrick's later films.
Certainly the scene that sticks out in my mind are like the shots where you're trailing behind Danny as he's riding his big wheel through the hallways. There's a... One of the things I remember most is when he's riding through, I guess it must be the lobby because there's hardwood and place carpets around,
right?
Spot carpets. And he's riding and he hits like hardwood and then goes over to the carpet. It's just like a nice, it seems like when he hits the carpet, it feels a little odd.
Yeah, well, it's very cool because you get like a humming sound as he goes across carpet,
mm-hmm.
Or across the hardwood, I'm sorry, and then it's like muffled as he goes across the carpet. So it's like a...
One thing I've read is that like for that opening scene, he doesn't do it in later scenes with the big wheel, where he had like the soundtrack cut. So when he was on the carpet, it made like kind of like, you know, kind of like odd little horror notes, I guess.
Almost like a choral.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you hear it, but it feels like it's muffled. So your mind doesn't necessarily register it.
Yeah.
But it was only for that scene because I don't recall it being. I think if you rewatch it, you can probably hear it much more clear now that you know. But I don't remember hearing that in maybe the second or third scene when he's on his big wheel, like where he sees the twins and so forth.
Yeah. Well, this was the first movie that Kubrick was able to use a Steadicam in, which had just been developed by a gentleman named Garrett Brown, who actually operated the Steadicam for the movie. Well, for most of the movie. For part of the film, he had to... The first time the Steadicam had been used was on Rocky, on the scenes where he is, like, walking through the meat locker and stuff. And he was contracted to do Rocky II, and The Shining ran over schedule, so...
It sounds like Kubrick.
Yeah. So he had to leave and train somebody to take over for him on The Shining so that he could go and shoot Rocky II. And then when he got finished shooting Rocky II, they were still shooting The Shining, so he came back. Yeah, like I said, those Steadicam shots became something that Kubrick just loved and reused over and over again. The Shining, Full Metal Jacket, and Eyes Wide Shut, his last three films. But it has its start in, I guess, a movie you have not seen, Paths of Glory.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
Which is great. You need to watch it. Paths of Glory is terrific. But there are shots of Kirk Douglas walking through the trenches in Paths of Glory where the camera is either in front or behind him.
Definitely The Shining, like, yeah, these hallways, man, are all, like, the building is certainly feels like a character. Those hallways are intimidating.
Yeah, and the spatial none of the spatial dimensions actually work out. Like, there's this whole thing about how after he walks into after he walks into the Overlook and walks around a couple of hallways and gets into the office of Ullman at the beginning of the movie, there's a big window behind his desk, and that you know, could not possibly be there. And there's plenty of other ones too, like, you know,
there's one of the scenes
where Danny is riding on his big wheel where he is on one floor of the Overlook, and then once he turns a corner, he's on a different
floor. He's where the rooms are.
Yeah, he's on a different floor altogether. I think that's the one where he sees the two Grady girls.
The Grady twins, yeah.
Well, they're not twins. The girls are not supposed to be twins in the movie.
Yeah, they're supposed to be 8 and 10. Is that what I heard?
He says that,
the guy interviewing says that in the beginning of the call. But I think the actresses are actually twins, though, right?
Maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, but yeah, I think it's the one where we see the Grady twins. And they're really creepy. One, because... Obviously, because they're dressed identically, and that there's something very...
They're not supposed to be there.
But there's something very odd about the symmetrical quality of two people dressing like that, like twins.
The twin, from our view, on the left, her face is in shadow quite a bit more than the other one, though.
Well, they both look oddly older. They almost like old people in young people bodies. Like, it's strange. There's just a really odd... Like, I'm sure that's why they were cast, because they just had an odd look to them. Like, in Orphan. Just the look of that little girl. You know, you could just tell that there is a...
Wise beyond her years.
Yeah, like a different kind of aging going on there, an experience that isn't usually present in children.
Mm-hmm.
So... Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, the hallway, as you talk about spatial, like, impossibilities, you know, there's, you know, the hedge maze, which features prominently in the middle and at the very end of the film.
Yeah.
Which, you know, do you know, was that actually shot on a hedge maze, or was that on a set?
They built it on a set, right?
Because, like, yeah, that's not real snow.
No, it's salt.
Yeah.
They used, and I can't remember the number, but it's something like 5 million pounds of salt or something like that, yeah.
Be kind of down with that. I wanted to go watching that, you know, not with an axe, really psychopath behind me, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, they used salt, and they did create snow, but they also used fog to make and wind machines so that as the fog moved in the wind machines, it almost looked like there was more snow than there was. Hmm. So it looked like blizzard conditions, but they weren't really using a lot of snow. They were using fog. So gotta stop saying so.
So what's next?
I don't know. What else? What else you'd like about this movie? Or don't like?
Let's talk about Scatman Crothers a little bit. We talked about it a little bit in the beginning, but yeah. I like his Bugs Bunny impersonation.
He famously had like a meltdown and cried on set and asked Kubrick, you know, Mr. Kubrick, what do you want? What are we looking for? Because they had done like 37 takes or whatever of just him walking down a hallway or something. So he just couldn't take it. He wasn't used to it because he wasn't really like, because he was a musician and he'd only acted a little bit. And so he was definitely not ready for the
Kubrick,
the level of work that was going to be needed for, you know, I mean, most directors do just a handful of takes, you know, some, if it's, you know, 8 or 10 takes, that's for a lot of people, that's a lot, you know. Clint Eastwood famously doesn't do like if it takes 3 takes, it's a lot for Clint Eastwood. So, and you know, you could see that in the quality of his movies too, especially the later ones. but somebody like David Fincher, you go in and you understand that, you know, that you're going to be put through the ringer and that if it takes 50 takes to get what he wants, you know, that's what you're going to do. And you know that ahead of time. And I think with Kubrick, the reputation was there, but still, even knowing that quote unquote, a lot of takes get used, that certain actors just weren't ready for it. I've heard stories of Ryan O'Neill on Barry Lyndon, not liking the exacting nature of Kubrick's direction and the number of takes. And, you know, Carruthers, like I said, famously had a big meltdown, but stuck with it. And, you know, like they did the scene where he talks to Danny, the ice cream scene, a ton of times. I don't have the number, but they did that scene a lot. And both he and Danny were real troopers, I hear. So
I'm sure Danny was all right eating all that ice cream.
Yeah, he probably had a stomach ache. I don't like chocolate ice cream anyway.
Whatever.
I don't.
Okay.
I like ice cream. Just don't like chocolate ice cream. Chocolate, like hot fudge on vanilla ice cream, that's fine. But like, I think chocolate ice cream tastes funny. Doesn't taste like chocolate to me sometimes. It's weird. We're getting off on a tangent here.
I had ice cream today.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any.
Pistachio ice cream
in Baskin Robbins. I didn't have any sweets today at all. Pistachio, huh? Like pistachios.
Me too. Yeah. Nice bright green. Tasty.
I think the color's weird, but, you know, it still tastes good. I'm a butter pecan man. I like butter pecans.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, I like the traditional ones, too. Mint chocolate chip cookie dough, strawberry.
I like Häagen-Dazs vanilla Swiss almond.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's my favorite.
I don't eat, you know, I'm trying to lose some weight, but I don't eat a lot of sweet stuff right now, but used to get plenty of Ben & Jerry's Cherry Garcia. Love that. That was so good.
Chunky monkey guy.
Yeah?
For Ben & Jerry's.
That's good, too. Mm. Yeah. I like banana Stephen Colbert stuff. Americone Dream is pretty good.
Mm. Never had it.
Yeah.
Ben & Jerry's is one of those things I think a lot of times there's too much. There's too much going on.
Yeah.
Too much going on there.
Let's you can get one of the simpler ones. They have one that's just like a chocolate caramel swirl. It's really good.
I guess. Yeah. But, I mean, there's probably better chocolate caramel swirls. If you're going to get Ben & Jerry's, you want to go all the way in.
Okay.
Yeah. Agree
to disagree.
A lot of bullshit. Sorry, there was a lot of fake snow on that set. Maybe ice cream.
We were talking about the number of takes. This is I don't know if it's been eclipsed at this point. I doubt it, but this movie was in the Guinness Book of World Records for the staircase scene where Wendy is backing up
with
swinging the bat, and they shot that 127 times, and it was the record for any scene that had dialogue in it. So there were other other scenes in other movies, and I can't tell you what they are, but other scenes in other movies where they did more than 127 takes, but it was...
There's a scene in a Jackie Chan film called The Young Master where he has to flip a fan, and I believe that is the current Guinness World Record holder most takes of a single scene.
How many?
Gosh, I'm looking it up right now. Yeah, it's okay. Hundreds, though.
Hundreds? God. Can't even imagine. I think most filmmakers at a certain point, after like 50, 60 takes, would probably be like, this isn't working, let's do something different.
Jackie Chan, he's a perfectionist in a different way
than Kubrick is. Absolutely. Yeah. And he makes very entertaining movies.
Yeah, I just watched one of those earlier this week.
We should do a Jackie Chan movie.
Oh, man. All right. Let's watch my favorite one.
Well, I know you're a huge Jackie Chan fan, so.
Yes. Let me see.
I will watch one if you want.
All right. We'll watch.
I've seen a handful, but we can watch one and review.
We'll watch Mr. Canton and Lady Rose, the one that's a remake of Frank Capra's Pocket Full of Miracles.
Really?
Yeah. Directed by Jackie Chan.
Doesn't sound like it's action oriented.
There's action.
I don't think Glenn Ford was drop kicking anybody in the
Jackie Chan does. Fights axe people and
is Michelle Yeoh in it?
No.
Oh.
It's got a guy named Wu Ma Anita Mui, who's very lovely. Lo Lie from Chow Brothers.
Oh yeah, okay.
He's got a pretty great fight with a guy named Billy Chow. And I don't think I should talk too much more about this if we're actually going to watch it. Yeah, I just got a new Blu-ray of it, so.
You're going to have to let me borrow it.
Yeah.
Is it a region 1?
Hong Kong and most of Asia are region A for Blues, so you don't need multiple region Blu-ray players to play an import from there.
Okay. Are you still searching for the number of takes?
I'm trying to.
Oh, okay. Well, while you're doing that, I'll just mention real quick that just as a cool little, trivia bit, most of the set of The Shining burned down.
Under mysterious circumstances.
And to be honest, there wasn't much left to shoot. And
Kubrick was like, eh.
Well, they shot it at Elstree Studios, which is where they famously shot Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark. And when the set burned down, Elstree, because Kubrick was over schedule. And they wanted him to vacate the sets so that Raiders of the Lost Ark could come in and build the Well of the Souls. And he had it in his contract that no matter what, if there was extra stuff to shoot, they had to let him do it. So he made them rebuild it for like 3 days of shooting or something like that.
That son of a bitch.
Yeah. And there's a story, and who knows whether this is true, so take this with a grain of salt, because, Kubrick and Spielberg had a real curious, vague professional relationship through the years after this incident, which led up to Spielberg directing AI. But apparently, Vivian Kubrick, Kubrick's daughter, who shot one of the behind the scenes,
yes.
Documentaries on The Shining, and she had unprecedented access, and if you get a chance to watch it, it's got some great stuff with Nicholson like revving up for his character, mm-hmm. and stuff. She apparently called like Animal Control on the Raiders of the Lost Ark set for fear that they were hurting snakes. And so they shut down like the Well of Souls set at one point, and Spielberg was like going crazy, and apparently so I can't remember.
They definitely kill a lot of bugs in Temple of Doom.
I can't remember if it's Jan Harlan, who was a producer on The Shining, and he was Kubrick's brother-in-law also, or if it was somebody else. But somebody who was involved in the production said that Kubrick just kind of like stood off to the side laughing, and he said, "Steve's a jerk."
That is pretty curious.
But when you hear Spielberg talk about Kubrick, he does it with such a... There's such a reverence, which I think is what I think is only natural, because he's looking at the work that the guy put out.
Yeah.
But
Kubrick's probably the only guy who could probably get away with something like that.
Yeah.
Spielberg, though. Okay. It looks like the fan scene, And Jackie Chan's Young Master took 329 takes.
329 takes. But was there dialogue involved?
There's dialogue during the fight, yes.
Okay, just checking.
He does it, and then he delivers a line, if I remember correctly.
Okay, cool. That's a lot. I would have given up before then, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Maybe that's why you're not Jackie Chan.
There's probably a few other reasons for that, too. Jackie's great, though. All right, cool. What else you want to talk about with The Shining?
I don't know. I see you took a little bit of notes. Anything we didn't cover on that?
Well, I mean, most of what you're looking at here is just the cast, so that if you wanted to know who played Delbert Grady, it's Philip Stone. And who played the Grady twins, it was Lisa and Louise Burns. Another little like tidbit of trivia, anybody who's read The Shining will know that room 237 is not the actual name of the room in the book. The room in the book is room 217. But they shot at a place called the Timberland Lodge, and the Timberland Lodge had a room 217, and they didn't want people to watch the movie and think that they should stay there.
They could make out with like hot ghosts that turn into hags.
Yeah. So they changed it from 217 to 237.
There isn't a 237.
Right, but it probably would have been the most popular room booked, though, to be honest. I think that would have been a big tourist thing. Like,
is it the Timberland Lodge that's there during the overhead shots at the beginning of the film?
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The one that doesn't have a hedge maze outside.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess you have to assume that the hedge maze is on the other side.
Yeah, but you're in a helicopter. You see the whole thing.
You're approaching the Timberland Lodge from the cliff face, essentially.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, you don't see the back. But yeah, like, even there's a couple of shots, especially the one where they are walking past the maze back into the hotel when he mentions the snow cat for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's like a whole middle section of the hotel that you see in the big helicopter shot that isn't there. Like, it's weird. There's all kinds of little things like that. Just oddball things. In Danny's bedroom, there's like a disappearing Dopey sticker on the wall. Like, when you walk into Danny's bedroom, there's all these stickers, like Disney stickers, like Dumbo and stuff like that on the wall. And one
Dopey
of them,
from the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah, Dopey is there on the wall. And they have the scene where the pediatrician examines him, and then when they go back out, Dopey's not on the wall anymore. And there's a scene with Jack and Wendy, when Wendy goes in and interrupts him, and when he gets really angry at her for the first time.
Yeah, fuck off.
And basically says, why don't you get the fuck out of here? There's a chair sitting behind
him. That scene is very chilling.
Yeah. Well, there's an empty chair sitting behind him during that scene that just disappears. You could chalk it up to a continuity error, but most people believe, and I think this is probably correct as well, that Kubrick was too much of a perfectionist and exacting filmmaker to allow something like that as continuity error to slip through. More than likely, it was done deliberately just to give the Overlook Hotel just another
weird mystery.
Yeah, just to sort of add to the mysterious quality of it. Yeah.
I guess there's not much more to talk about for this film. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have seen it. What's your take on the ending? What do you think is the meaning of the final shot, the final photograph?
I don't know what the meaning of it is. You know, I think that's certainly open to interpretation.
I think that's one of the reasons I don't want to watch 237. I think it's much better to make these connections on your own.
Yeah.
My gut tells me that in the film, you know, there are all these spirits, and, you know, within the universe of this film, I do think something supernatural is going on. You know, you mentioned the, you know, substance abuse angle, and I guess it's easy, especially today with fan theories being all the rage, to, you know, just to say, oh, it was all in so-and-so's head this whole time.
Right.
You know?
I hate those movies usually, though. I hate, like Identity with John Cusack.
I've never seen it.
You ever seen that?
No.
Well, like that.
I'm probably not, because you hate it.
That's a movie that has one of those.
Is it all in his head?
Well,
is it all in his head?
I think I already gave it away. Sorry, spoiler.
But yeah, I think you know, with like the spirits say he's always been, and he's, you know, exists. You know, there's a picture of Jack in the photograph, you know, he's like a reincarnation maybe. And, you know, same thing with Grady, that, you know, people who were there at one point, you know, are being drawn back to that hotel. But you got to imagine that at some point it's going to be, yeah, you know, people keep on dying here.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly possible. I mean, yeah, I agree. There's definitely a supernatural quality to the whole thing, you know, which is intended. That's like, that's the biggest thing about the book, is that the house is a literal character. It is haunted, and it's not about the family going mad. It's about how the house wants Danny, because of Danny's psychic ability. Whereas Kubrick kind of pushes all that to the side and makes the focus of it the characters, the relationships between them, and the, you know, their descent into madness as a family unit. Which is another allegorical substance abuse thing, that it's not just you, it's everyone around you gets sucked in as well.
There's, I guess we should make a note that there's a follow-up novel that was released a few years ago.
Yeah.
Called Dr. Sleepless, I think is the name of it.
Dr. Sleep.
Dr. Whatever.
Yeah.
Dr. Something. But it follows Danny as an adult who, I guess, finds a young girl who also has psychic ability. So he kind of takes that upon himself to kind of mentor her the way he was mentored as a...
By Halloran.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who in the book, as I understand it, does not die. He survives
the book. He saves them, actually. Yeah.
Maybe I should read The Shining one day.
Slim Pickens, who was in Dr. Strangelove, as Major Kong, I think that's the name of his character. He's the one who rides the... He rides the bomb at the end of the movie, you know, bucking like a Bronco, waving his hat. He was originally offered the part of Halloran and turned it down because he didn't want to work with Kubrick again.
He's like, that guy's a bitch.
But it's just one of those things, you know, like I think certain directors, because they are more interested in the final product and are willing to go to whatever measure it takes to get their vision on screen. Sometimes actors are happy to have been in it, but would never want to experience it again. I've heard, you know, people say that about Terrence Malick, but they would never do another Terrence Malick movie.
Do you think Adrian Brody will ever do?
No, I don't think Adrian Brody will. He's not the one I'm referring to, but certainly, there were a couple of people on the Thin Red Line who have mentioned that they would not work with Malick again. And everyone talks about how, what a sweetheart he is and how he's terrific, but like,
they don't like putting in the work and not have anything
to show for it. Exactly. Right. Yeah.
I was trying to think, like, I just read somewhere that there was an actress who had all of her scenes cut. It was like an A-list actress, but I can't recall what film.
It's like an ongoing joke now when people get interviewed after they've shot a Malick movie.
Like, I don't know. We'll see.
Before it comes out,
we'll see.
Journalists are always saying, do you think you're going to make the cut? and most of them are like, they're in on it. So they're just like, I don't know. You just never know with Terry. So.
Terry M.
Yep. Cool. Well, good talk.
Chats.
I don't really have anything else specifically, you know, that I wanted to mention. I'm sure there's more we could talk about. You know, I mean, certain scenes in this movie, I think we could, you know, literally just dissect and talk about performance. I mean, you know, we barely even scratched the surface of Jack Nicholson in this movie as far as like his performance itself. For those of you who are listening, I would definitely recommend you go back and revisit The Shining. There is one thing, which I kind of half mentioned yesterday, but I didn't finish it because I didn't, you know, didn't want you to have to sit through it twice. Essentially,
you're welcome. Thanks for thinking about me.
Yeah, you're welcome. But I do own the old white case Stanley Kubrick box set, which came out in like 2000. Maybe late 99, early 2000. Warner Brothers released it. And of course, there's a couple movies that are from a different studio, like 2001 is in it from MGM. But, you know, all of Kubrick's later movies were through Warner Brothers. And most of them are presented in full frame, 4x3, you know, like Academy standard, not widescreen.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them, including Eyes Wide Shut, The Shining, and Full Metal Jacket, have a little blurb on the back of the box that says that they're presented in full frame as Stanley Kubrick intended. So for years, I believed that. I thought that was the case. And when I would watch a Kubrick film, one of the reasons that I thought they were visually interesting was because he was using that sort of boxy format. And
the expectation to shoot it in 4x3.
Yeah. And
is this not the case? You're going to blow my mind right now.
I'm probably not going to blow your mind, but yes, you can understand what I'm getting to already. Apparently Kubrick's intended aspect ratio, was actually 1:6:6:1, which isn't really widescreen. But it's not full frame either. So I rebought The Shining on the new Warner Brothers Blu-ray to watch it for this podcast. And when I put it in, it was filling my HD screen. It was 16:9. And I was so sure that that wasn't correct. So, you know, I pulled the Blu-ray out. I looked at my Blu-ray, settings. I looked at my TV settings. I went in and I made it 4x3, and it didn't matter. It still came up 16:9. So I looked at the back, and the back of the Blu-ray says presented in 16:9. And I was like, what the fuck? I was like, you're butchering Stanley Kubrick's visual, like, you know, language. And so I did a little bit of research, and by no means am I an authority on this, but I'll give you the short version. It's that, you know, Stanley Kubrick knew after watching movies like 2001 on television and seeing how they got butchered, he knew that he would have to make future movies and compose them for multiple formats. So in America, movie screens were essentially Panavision 1.85:1. And in Great Britain, they were going to be, in many cases, 1.66:1. So he would compose them so that you would get TV safe and 1.85:1 without losing too much, but his preferred format was 1.66:1. And in Europe, many of the Blu-rays and DVDs are available in that 1.66:1 ratio. None of them are here in the States.
That's a goddamn atrocity.
And if anybody from Warner Brothers is listening, and I doubt they are, but it's fucking time to make this right. Like, please make sure that you guys go back and redo these with the correct aspect ratio, because I was pretty upset. I was actually talking to our friend Joe, and I was like, for years, I was like...
Did you know about this? Did Joe know about this?
Joe did not know about it ahead of time. I told him, mm-hmm. You know. So I found this interview with his personal assistant, and his personal assistant was going through and talking about what Kubrick's philosophy was on the aspect ratios and what he wanted. And I just kept thinking to myself, why does nobody at Warner Brothers give a shit about this? Like, for real, can you give it to me, you know, in the 1.66:1? And that actually leads me to a bigger conversation that we don't have to get into, because, you know, we're running a little bit long here as it is. But I hate the current home video, and not just DVD Blu-ray, because that's my preferred way of watching it. But I've heard horror stories of Netflix butchering aspect ratios, you know, just to make sure that they look like everything else that's on Netflix, and other streaming services, same thing. Why are we not getting the original aspect ratios, or at least having that as an option? It's not just Warner Brothers. It's not just Fox. It's everybody. Like, they're so afraid. Just like before, they wanted to pan and scan everything because people were like, "What are these black bars at the top of the screen?" Right. So, but now, for the most part, we're much more savvy, you know, as far as, you know, being home viewers. And I think, you know, I don't know. I think it's a real tragedy that a lot of these movies are being altered without the consent of the filmmakers, especially classic movies. So I guess, you know, I'll end it there. I could probably rant a little bit longer, but no one wants to hear that. But in terms of Kubrick's work, I was really taken aback watching The Shining in high def Blu-ray, because it looked very odd to me not to have the boxiness. It looked very odd not to have the extra headroom on the shots. You know, I mean, some of the shots, you know, especially I've not rebought any of the other Kubrick films on Blu-ray, at least the later ones. I've Dr. Strangelove and Paths of Glory and a few others. But as far as Eyes Wide Shut or Full Metal Jacket is concerned, I have not rebought either of those on Blu-ray. And at this point, I probably won't. Because of this. God, please don't tell me that Eyes Wide Shut is 16:9, because they're like, I felt watching that movie that there was some of the best modern era 4:3 compositions in that movie. And it really would break my heart, I think, to watch it in 16:9. And I really do like that movie. I'm probably one of the few people, actually our friend Joe is a big fan of it too. I'm one of the few people that I know who really loves Eyes Wide Shut.
I think
screw you, Warner Brothers. Tom Cruise, make this happen.
I don't know if it's gonna happen.
Probably not.
Yeah, let's fix this movie from 1997, 98, 99.
Eyes Wide Shut. Mm. Eyes Wide Shut came out in 99. One of the great years there. You know.
Okay.
Yeah, Matrix, Star Wars, Eyes Wide Shut.
Wasn't it 98?
No. 99, 100%.
Okay. Okay.
Anyway, let's wrap it up for the folks at home.
Okay.
Where can people find you on the internet?
You find me writing for filmsmash.com, just the way it sounds, or on Twitter or Instagram at Junior Beho. JUNIORBEHO.
Yes.
How about you, CJ?
Where can people find you
if we want to talk to you?
No one wants to talk to me.
I do.
You can find me on Twitter at Setting the Frame.
All right.
And that's it. So we haven't decided what we're going to do for next time. We were going to do another horror episode. Maybe we still will. Maybe we should just pick a single horror movie to do. But we'll let you guys know in the forums.
We want suggestions.
Well, we did a poll.
We did Shining.
We did The Shining because it won the poll. So thank you everyone who voted and put your opinion out there for us. And I know a lot of you, I think second place was The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really talk about it, but I mentioned that I rewatched it. I rewatched it for you guys. So thank you for the suggestion.
Yeah. Way to make me seem less. way to make me seem less, CJ.
Yeah.
I care just as much about CJ, maybe more. Definitely more.
You care about me, or we care
about the them? About their suggestions.
You care about them as yes. much as I do? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I believe that. No one's disputing that, actually.
That's just the way it sounded.
I was not insinuating, sir. Okay. Well, we're done. Let's wrap it up. Good talk. Thanks for joining me, Cesar.
No problem.
And hope you guys have a fantastic Halloween, actually. So, let us know if you guys have pictures of yourselves in costume for Halloween or something. You should feel free to tag us and to show us.
Yeah, I have an idea for a film related one, so maybe you guys will see it soon. I think I'm working that day though, so
I can't wait. That's awesome. Cool. Well, you guys take care. We will talk to you next time.
All right, see you guys.
Bye.